stared after him, frowning.
"Is something wrong?" the prince asked, eyeing the bishop closely.
"Yes," Valdespino replied, turning back to Julian. "I've been taking confessions for 50 years. I know a lie when I hear one."
Chapter 34 ConspiracyNet.com. Breaking news. Online community erupts with questions. In the wake of Edmund Kirsch's assassination, the futurist's massive online following has erupted in a firestorm of speculation over two urgent issues. What was Kirsch's discovery? Who killed him and why? Regarding Kirsch's discovery, theories have already flooded the internet and span a wide range of topics, from Darwin to extraterrestrials to creationism and beyond. No motive has yet been confirmed for this killing, but theories include religious zealotry, corporate espionage, and jealousy. ConspiracyNet has been promised exclusive information about the killer, and we will share it with you the moment it arrives.
Chapter 35 Ambra Vidal stood alone in the cabin of the water taxi, clutching Robert Langdon's jacket around her. Minutes ago, when Langdon asked why she had agreed to marry a man she barely knew, Ambra had replied truthfully, "I was given no choice." Her engagement to Julian was a misfortune she could not bear to relive tonight, not with everything else that had happened. "I was trapped. I'm still trapped." Now, as Ambra looked at her own reflection in the dirty window, she felt an overwhelming sense of loneliness engulf her. Ambra Vidal was not one to indulge in self-pity, but at the moment her heart felt brittle and adrift. "I'm engaged to a man who is involved somehow in a brutal murder." The prince had sealed Edmund's fate with a single phone call only an hour before the event. Ambra had been frantically preparing for the arrival of the guests when a young staff member had rushed in, excitedly waving a slip of paper.
"Señora Vidal, mensaje para usted."
The girl was giddy and explained in breathless Spanish that an important call had just come in to the museum's front desk.
"Our caller ID," she squeaked, "said Royal Palace of Madrid, and so of course I answered, and it was someone calling from the office of Prince Julian."
"They called the front desk?" Ambra asked. "They have my cell number."
"The prince's assistant said he tried your mobile," the staffer explained, "but they couldn't get through."
Ambra checked her phone. Odd. No missed call. Then she realized that some technicians had just been testing the museum's cellular jamming system, and Julian's assistant must have called while her phone was disabled.
"It seems the prince got a call today from a very important friend in Bilbao who wants to attend tonight's event."
The girl handed Ambra the slip of paper.
"He hoped you would be able to add one name to tonight's guest list?"
Ambra eyed the message. "Almirante Luis Avila, retirado, Armada Española." A retired officer from the Spanish Navy?
"They left a number and said you can call back directly if you want to discuss it, but that Julian was about to go into a meeting, so you probably won't reach him. But the caller insisted that the prince does hope this request is not an imposition."
"An imposition?" Ambra smoldered. "Considering what you've already put me through?"
"I'll take care of it," Ambra said. "Thank you."
The young staffer danced away as if she'd just relayed the word of God himself. Ambra glared at the prince's request, irritated that he would think it appropriate to exert his influence with her in this way, especially after lobbying so hard against her participation in tonight's event.
"Once again, you leave me no choice," she thought.
If she ignored this request, the result would be an uncomfortable confrontation with a prominent naval officer at the front door. Tonight's event was meticulously choreographed and would attract unparalleled media coverage. "The last thing I need is an embarrassing tussle with one of Julian's high-powered friends." Admiral Avila had not been vetted or placed on the cleared list, but Umbra suspected that demanding a security check was both unnecessary and potentially insulting. After all, the man was a distinguished naval officer with enough power to pick up the phone, call the royal palace, and ask the future king for a favor. And so, facing a tight schedule, Umbra made the only decision she could make. She wrote Admiral Avila's name on the guest list at the front door, and also added it to the docenting database so a headset could be initialized for this new guest. Then she went back to work. "And now Edmund is dead," Umbra reflected, returning to the present moment in the darkness of the water taxi. As she tried to rid her mind of the painful memories, a strange thought occurred to her. "I never spoke directly to Julian. The entire message was relayed through third parties." The notion brought with it a small ray of hope. Is it possible that Robert is right? And that maybe Julian is innocent? She considered it a moment longer, and then hurried outside. She found the American professor standing alone on the bow, hands on the railing as he stared out into the night. Umbra joined him there, startled to see that the boat had left the main branch of the Nervión River and was now skimming northward along a small tributary that seemed less of a river than a perilous channel with high muddy banks. The shallow water and tight quarters made Umbra nervous, but their boat captain seemed unfazed, racing along the narrow gorge at top speed, his headlight blazing the way. She quickly told Langdon about the call from Prince Julian's office.
"All I really know is that the museum's front desk got a call that originated in the Royal Palace of Madrid. Technically, that call could have been from anyone there claiming to be Julian's assistant."
Langdon nodded. "That may be why the person chose to relay the request to you, rather than talk to you directly. Any idea who might be involved?" Considering Edmund's history with Valdespino, Langdon was inclined to look toward the bishop himself.
"It could be anybody," Umbra said. "It's a delicate time in the palace right now. With Julian taking center stage, a lot of the old advisers are scrambling to find favor and gain Julian's ear. The country is changing, and I think a lot of the old guard are desperate to retain power."
"Well, whoever is involved," Langdon said. "Let's hope they don't figure out we're trying to locate Edmund's password and release his discovery." As he spoke the words, Langdon felt the stark simplicity of their challenge. He also sensed its blunt peril. Edmund was murdered to keep this information from being released. For an instant, Langdon wondered if his safest option might be simply to fly directly home from the airport and let someone else handle all this. Safe, yes, he thought, but an option? No. Langdon felt a profound sense of duty toward his old student, along with moral outrage that a scientific breakthrough could be so brutally censored. He also felt a deep intellectual curiosity to learn exactly what Edmund had discovered. And finally, Langdon knew, there is Umbra Vidal. The woman was clearly in crisis, and when she had looked into his eyes and pleaded for help, Langdon had sensed in her a deep well of personal conviction and self-reliance. Yet he had also seen heavy clouds of fear and regret. "There are secrets there," he sensed, "dark and confining. She is reaching out for help." Umbra raised her eyes suddenly, as if sensing Langdon's thoughts.
"You look cold," she said. "You need your jacket back."
He smiled softly. "I'm fine."
"Are you thinking you should leave Spain as soon as we get to the airport?"
Langdon laughed. "Actually, that did cross my mind."
"Please don't."
She reached out to the railing and placed her soft hand on top of his.
"I'm not sure what we're facing tonight. You were close to Edmund, and he told me more than once how much he valued your friendship and trusted your opinion. I'm scared, Robert, and I really don't think I can face this alone."
Umbra's flashes of unguarded candor were startling to Langdon, and yet also utterly captivating.
Okay, he said, nodding. You and I owe it to Edmund, and frankly, to the scientific community, to find that password and make his work public. Ambra smiled softly.
Thank you.
Langdon glanced behind the boat. I imagine your Guardia agents have realized by now that we've left the museum.
No doubt. But Winston was quite impressive, wasn't he?
Mind-boggling, Langdon replied, only now starting to grasp the quantum leap Edmund had made in the development of AI. Whatever Edmund's proprietary breakthrough technologies had been, clearly he had been poised to usher in a brave new world of human-computer interaction. Tonight Winston had proven himself a faithful servant to his creator, as well as an invaluable ally to Langdon and Ambra. In a matter of minutes, Winston had identified a threat on the guest list, attempted to thwart Edmund's assassination, identified the getaway car, and facilitated Langdon and Ambra's escape from the museum. Let's hope Winston phoned ahead to alert Edmund's pilots, Langdon said.
I'm sure he did, Ambra said. But you're right. I should call Winston to double-check.
Hold on, Langdon said, surprised. You can call Winston? When we left the museum and went out of range, I thought...
Ambra laughed and shook her head.
Robert, Winston is not physically located inside the Guggenheim. He is located in a secret computer facility somewhere and accessed remotely. Do you really think Edmund would build a resource like Winston and not be able to communicate with him at all times, anywhere in the world? Edmund talked to Winston all the time, at home, traveling, out for walks. The two of them could connect at any moment with a simple phone call. I've seen Edmund chat for hours with Winston. Edmund used him like a personal assistant, to call for dinner reservations, to coordinate with his pilots, to do anything that needed doing, really. In fact, when we were mounting the museum show, I talked to Winston quite often myself by phone.
Ambra reached inside the pocket of Langdon's tails jacket and pulled out Edmund's turquoise-covered phone, flicking it on. Langdon had powered it down in the museum to save its battery.
You should turn on your phone, too, she said, so we both have access to Winston.
You're not worried about being tracked if we turn these on? Ambra shook her head.
The authorities haven't had time to get the necessary court order, so I think it's worth the risk, especially if Winston can update us on the Guardia's progress and the situation at the airport.
Uneasy, Langdon turned on his phone and watched it come to life. As the home screen materialized, he squinted into the light and felt a twinge of vulnerability, as if he had just become instantly locatable to every satellite in space. You've seen too many spy movies, he told himself. All at once, Langdon's phone began pinging and vibrating as a backlog of messages from this evening began pouring in. To his astonishment, Langdon had received more than 200 texts and emails since turning off his phone. As he scanned the inbox, he saw the messages were all from friends and colleagues. The earlier emails had congratulatory header lines. Great lecture. I can't believe you're there. But then, very suddenly, the tone of the headers turned anxious and deeply concerned, including a message from his book editor, Jonas Faulkman. My God, Robert, are you okay? Langdon had never seen his scholarly editor employ all caps or double punctuation. Until now, Langdon had been feeling wonderfully invisible in the darkness of Bilbao's waterways, as if the museum were a fading dream. It's all over the world, he realized. News of Kirsch's mysterious discovery and brutal murder, along with my name and face.
Winston has been trying to reach us, Ambra said, staring into the glow of Kirsch's cell phone. Edmund has received 53 missed calls in the last half hour, all from the same number, all exactly 30 seconds apart, she chuckled. Tireless persistence is among Winston's many virtues.
Just then, Edmund's phone began ringing. Langdon smiled at Ambra. I wonder who it is. She held out the phone to him.
Answer it.
Langdon took the phone and pressed the speaker button. Hello?
Professor Langdon, chimed Winston's voice with its familiar British accent. I'm glad we're back in contact. I've been trying to reach you.
Yes, we can see that, Langdon replied, impressed that the computer sounded so utterly calm and unruffled after 53 consecutive failed calls.
There have been some developments, Winston said. There is a possibility that the airport authorities will be alerted to your names before you arrive. Once again, I will suggest you follow my directions very carefully.
We're in your hands, Winston, Langdon said. Tell us what to do.
First thing, Professor, Winston said, if you have not jettisoned your cell phone, you need to do so immediately.
Really? Langdon gripped his phone more tightly. Don't the authorities need a court order before anyone...
On an American cop show, perhaps. But you are dealing with Spain's Guardia Real and the Royal Palace. They will do what is necessary.
Langdon eyed his phone, feeling strangely reluctant to part with it. My whole life is in there.
What about Edmund's phone? Ambra asked, sounding alarmed.
Untraceable, Winston replied. Edmund was always concerned about hacking and corporate espionage. He personally wrote an IMEI/IMSI veiling program that varies his phone's C2 values to outsmart any GSM interceptors.
Of course he did, Langdon thought, for the genius who created Winston outsmarting a local phone company would be a cakewalk. Langdon frowned at his own apparently inferior phone. Just then, Umbra reached over and gently pried it from his hands. Without a word, she held it over the railing and let it go.
Langdon watched the phone plummet down and splash into the dark waters of the Nervión River. As it disappeared beneath the surface, he felt a pang of loss, staring back after it as the boat raced on.
Robert, Ambra whispered, just remember the wise words of Disney's Princess Elsa.
Langdon turned. I'm sorry?
Ambra smiled softly.
Let it go.
Chapter 36.
Su misión todavía no ha terminado,
declared the voice on Avila's phone. Your mission is not yet complete. Avila sat up at attention in the back seat of the Uber as he listened to his employer's news. We've had an unexpected complication, his contact said in rapid Spanish. We need you to redirect to Barcelona right away. Barcelona? Avila had been told he would be traveling to Madrid for further service. We have reason to believe, the voice continued, that two associates of Mr. Kirsch are traveling to Barcelona tonight in hopes of finding a way to trigger Mr. Kirsch's presentation remotely. Avila stiffened.
Is that possible?
We're not sure yet, but if they succeed, obviously it will undo all of your hard work. I need a man on the ground in Barcelona right away, discreetly. Get there as fast as you can, and call me. With that, the connection was terminated.
The bad news felt strangely welcome to Avila. I am still needed. Barcelona was farther than Madrid, but still only a few hours at top speed on a superhighway in the middle of the night. Without wasting a moment, Avila raised his gun and pressed it against the Uber driver's head. The man's hands tensed visibly on the wheel.
Llévame a Barcelona, Avila commanded.
The driver took the next exit, toward Vitoria Gasteiz, eventually accelerating onto the A1 highway, heading east. The only other vehicles on the road at this hour were thundering tractor trailers, all racing to complete their runs to Pamplona, to Huesca, to Lleida, and finally to one of the largest port cities on the Mediterranean Sea, Barcelona. Avila could scarcely believe the strange sequence of events that had brought him to this moment. From the depths of my deepest despair, I have risen to the moment of my most glorious service. For a dark instant, Avila was back in that bottomless pit, crawling across the smoke-filled altar at the Cathedral of Seville, searching the blood-stained rubble for his wife and child, only to realize they were gone forever. For weeks after the attack,
Avila did not leave his home. He lay trembling on his couch, consumed by an endless waking nightmare of fiery demons that dragged him into a dark abyss, shrouding him in blackness, rage, and suffocating guilt.
"The abyss is purgatory,"
a nun whispered beside him, one of the hundreds of grief counselors trained by the church to assist survivors.
"Your soul is trapped in a dark limbo. Absolution is the only escape. You must find a way to forgive the people who did this, or your rage will consume you whole."
She made the sign of the cross.
"Forgiveness is your only salvation."
Forgiveness? Avila tried to speak, but demons clenched his throat. At the moment, revenge felt like the only salvation. But revenge against whom? Responsibility for the bombing had never been claimed.
"I realize acts of religious terrorism seem unforgivable," the nun continued, "and yet it may be helpful to remember that our own faith waged a centuries-long inquisition in the name of our God. We killed innocent women and children in the name of our beliefs. For this, we have had to ask forgiveness from the world and from ourselves, and through time, we have healed."
Then she read to him from the Bible.
"Do not resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you."
That night, alone and in pain, Avila stared into the mirror. The man looking back at him was a stranger. The nun's words had done nothing to ease his pain. Forgiveness? Turn my other cheek? I have witnessed evil for which there is no absolution. In a growing rage, Avila drove his fist into the mirror, shattering the glass and collapsing in sobs of anguish on his bathroom floor. As a career naval officer, Avila had always been a man in control, a champion of discipline, honor, and the chain of command. But that man was gone. Within weeks, Avila had fallen into a haze, anesthetizing himself with a potent blend of alcohol and prescription drugs. Soon his yearning for the numbing effects of chemicals occupied every waking hour, diminishing him to a hostile recluse. Within months, the Spanish Navy had quietly forced him to retire. A once powerful battleship, now stuck in dry dock. Avila knew he would never sail again. The Navy to which he had given his life had left him with only a modest stipend on which he could barely live. "I'm 58 years old," he realized, "and I have nothing." He spent his days sitting alone in his living room, watching TV, drinking vodka, and waiting for any ray of light to appear. La hora más oscura es justo antes del amanecer, he would tell himself over and over. But the old Navy aphorism proved false over and over. The darkest hour is not just before the dawn, he sensed. The dawn is never coming. On his 59th birthday, a rainy Thursday morning, staring at an empty bottle of vodka and an eviction warning, Avila mustered the courage to go to his closet, take down his Navy service pistol, load it, and put the barrel to his temple.
Perdóname,
he whispered, and closed his eyes. Then he squeezed the trigger. The explosion was far quieter than he imagined, more of a click than a gunshot. Cruelly, the gun had failed to fire. Years in a dusty closet without being cleaned had apparently taken a toll on the Admiral's cheap ceremonial pistol. It seemed even this simple act of cowardice was beyond Avila's abilities. Enraged, he hurled the gun at the wall. This time an explosion rocked the room. Avila felt a searing heat rip through his calf and his drunken fog lifted in a flash of blinding pain. He fell to the floor, screaming and clutching his bleeding leg. Panicked neighbors pounded on his door, sirens wailed, and Avila soon found himself at Seville's Hospital Provincial de San Lázaro, attempting to explain how he had tried to kill himself by shooting himself in the leg. The next morning, as he lay in the recovery room, broken and humiliated, Admiral Luis Avila received a visitor. "You're a lousy shot," the young man said in Spanish. "No wonder they forced you to retire." Before Avila could reply, the man threw open the window shades and let the sunlight pour in. Avila shielded his eyes, now able to see that the kid was muscle-bound and had a buzz cut. He wore a T-shirt with the face of Jesus on it. "My name's Marco," he said, his accent Andalus. "I'm your trainer for rehab. I asked to be assigned to you because you and I have something in common." "Military?" Avila said, noting his brash demeanor. "Nope." The kid locked eyes with Avila. "I was there, that Sunday morning, in the cathedral. The terrorist attack." Avila stared in disbelief. "You were there?" The kid reached down and pulled up one leg of his sweats, revealing a prosthetic limb. "I realize you've been through hell, but I was playing semi-pro football, so don't expect too much sympathy from me. I'm more of a God helps those who help themselves kind of guy." Before Avila knew what had happened, Marco heaved him into a wheelchair, rolled him down the hall to a small gym, and propped him up between a pair of parallel bars. "This will hurt," the kid said, "but try to get to the other end. Just do it once, then you can have breakfast." The pain was excruciating, but Avila was not about to complain to someone with only one leg. So, using his arms to bear most of his weight, he shuffled all the way to the end of the bars. "Nice," Marco said. "Now do it again."
"But you said..."
"Yeah, I lied. Do it again."
Avila eyed the kid, stunned. The admiral had not taken an order in years, and strangely, he found something refreshing about it. It made him feel young, the way he had felt as a raw recruit years ago. Avila turned around and began shuffling back the other way.
"So tell me," Marco said, "do you still go to Mass at the Seville Cathedral?"
"Never."
"Fear?"
Avila shook his head.
"Rage."
Marco laughed.
"Yeah, let me guess. The nuns told you to forgive the attackers."
Avila stopped short on the bars.
"Exactly."
"Me too. I tried." "Impossible. The nuns gave us terrible advice."
He laughed. Avila eyed the young man's Jesus shirt.
"But it looks like you're still..."
"Oh, yeah.
I'm definitely still a Christian, more devout than ever.
I was fortunate to find my mission, helping victims of God's enemies."
"A noble cause,"
Avila said enviously, feeling his own life was purposeless without his family or the Navy.
"A great man helped bring me back to God," Marco continued. "That man, by the way, was the Pope. I have met him personally many times."
"I'm sorry, the Pope?"
"Yes."
"As in the leader of the Catholic Church?"
"Yes. If you like, I could probably arrange an audience for you."
Avila stared at the kid as if he'd lost his mind.
"You can get me an audience with the Pope?"
Marco looked hurt.
"I realize you're a big naval officer and can't imagine that a crippled physical trainer from Seville has access to the Vicar of Christ, but I'm telling you the truth. I can arrange a meeting with him if you like. He could probably help you find your way back, just the way he helped me."
Avila leaned on the parallel bars, uncertain how to reply. He idolized the then Pope, a staunch conservative leader who preached strict traditionalism and orthodoxy. Unfortunately, the man was under fire from all sides of the modernizing globe, and there were rumblings that he would soon choose to retire in the face of growing liberal pressure.
I'd be honored to meet him, of course, but...
Good, Marco interjected. I'll try to set it up for tomorrow. Avila never imagined that the following day he would find himself sitting deep within a secure sanctuary, face to face with a powerful leader who would teach him the most empowering religious lesson of his life. The roads to salvation are many. Forgiveness is not the only path.
Chapter 37. Located on the ground floor of the Madrid Palace, the Royal Library is a spectacularly ornate suite of chambers containing thousands of priceless tomes, including Queen Isabella's illuminated Book of Hours, the personal Bibles of several kings, and an iron-bound codex from the era of Alfonso XI. Garza entered in a rush, not wanting to leave the prince alone upstairs in the clutches of Valdespino for too long. He was still trying to make sense of the news that Valdespino had met with Kirsch only days ago, and had decided to keep the meeting a secret. Even in light of Kirsch's presentation and murder tonight? Garza moved across the vast darkness of the library toward PR coordinator Monica Martin, who was waiting in the shadows holding her glowing tablet.
"I realize you're busy, sir," Martin said, "but we have a highly time-sensitive situation. I came upstairs to find you because our security center received a disturbing email from conspiracynet.com.
From whom?
ConspiracyNet is a popular conspiracy theory site. The journalism is shoddy, and it's written at a child's level, but they have millions of followers. If you ask me, they hawk fake news, but the site is quite well respected among conspiracy theorists."
In Garza's mind, the terms well-respected and conspiracy theory seemed mutually exclusive.
"They've been scooping the Kirsch situation all night," Martin continued. "I don't know where they're getting their information, but the site has become a hub for news bloggers and conspiracy theorists. Even the networks are turning to them for breaking news."
"Come to the point," Garza pressed.
ConspiracyNet has new information that relates to the palace,"
Martine said, pushing her glasses up on her face.
"They're going public with it in 10 minutes and wanted to give us a chance to comment beforehand."
Garza stared at the young woman in disbelief.
"The royal palace doesn't comment on sensationalist gossip."
"At least look at it, sir."
Martine held out her tablet. Garza snatched the screen and found himself looking at a second photo of Navy Admiral Luis Avila. The photo was uncentered, as if taken by accident, and showed Avila in full dress whites striding in front of a painting. It looked as if it had been taken by a museum-goer who was attempting to photograph a piece of artwork and had inadvertently captured Avila as he blindly stepped into the shot.
"I know what Avila looks like," Garza snapped, eager to get back to the prince and Valdespino. "Why are you showing this to me?"
"Swipe to the next photo."
Garza swiped. The next screen showed an enlargement of the photo. This one focused on the admiral's right hand as it swung out in front of him. Garza immediately saw a marking on Avila's palm. It appeared to be a tattoo. Garza stared at the image for a long moment. The symbol was one he knew well, as did many Spaniards, especially the older generations. The symbol of Franco. Emblazoned in many places in Spain during the middle of the 20th century, the symbol was synonymous with the ultra-conservative dictatorship of General Francisco Franco, whose brutal regime advocated nationalism, authoritarianism, militarism, anti-liberalism, and national Catholicism. This ancient symbol, Garza knew, consisted of six letters which, when put together, spelled a single word in Latin, a word that perfectly defined Franco's self-image. Victor. Ruthless, violent, and uncompromising, Francisco Franco had risen to power with the military support of Nazi Germany and Mussolini's Italy. He killed thousands of his opponents before seizing total control of the country in 1939 and proclaiming himself El Caudillo, the Spanish equivalent of the Führer. During the Civil War and well into the first years of dictatorship, those who dared oppose him disappeared into concentration camps, where an estimated 300,000 were executed. Depicting himself as the defender of Catholic Spain and the enemy of godless communism, Franco had embraced a starkly male-centric mentality, officially excluding women from many positions of power in society, giving them barely any rights to professorships, judgeships, bank accounts, or even the right to flee an abusive husband. He annulled all marriages that had not been performed according to Catholic doctrine and, among other restrictions, he outlawed divorce, contraception, abortion, and homosexuality. Fortunately, everything had now changed. Even so, Garza was stunned by how quickly the nation had forgotten one of the darkest periods in its history. Spain's Pacto de Olvido, a nationwide political agreement to forget everything that had happened under Franco's vicious rule, meant that schoolchildren in Spain had been taught very little about the dictator. A poll in Spain had revealed that teenagers were far more likely to recognize the actor James Franco than they were dictator Francisco Franco. The older generations, however, would never forget. This victor symbol, like the Nazi swastika, could still conjure fear in the hearts of those old enough to remember those brutal years. To this day, wary souls warned that the highest reaches of Spanish government and the Catholic Church still harbored a secret faction of Francoist supporters, a hidden fraternity of traditionalists sworn to return Spain to its far-right convictions of the past century. Garza had to admit that there were plenty of old-timers who looked at the chaos and spiritual apathy of contemporary Spain and felt that the country could be saved only by a stronger state religion, a more authoritarian government, and the imposition of clearer moral guidelines. "Look at our youth," they would shout. "They're all adrift." In recent months, with the Spanish throne soon to be occupied by the younger Prince Julian, there was a rising fear among traditionalists that the royal palace itself would soon become another voice for progressive change in the country. Fueling their concern was the prince's recent engagement to Ambra Vidal, who was not only Basque, but outspokenly agnostic, and who, as Spain's queen, would no doubt have the prince's ear on matters of church and state. Dangerous days, Garza knew. A contentious cusp between past and future. In addition to a deepening religious rift, Spain faced a political crossroads as well. Would the country retain its monarch? Or would the royal crown be forever abolished, as it had been in Austria, Hungary, and so many other European countries? Only time would tell. In the streets, older traditionalists waved Spanish flags, while young progressives proudly wore their anti-monarchic colors of purple, yellow, and red, the colors of the old Republican banner. Julian will be inheriting a powder keg.
"When I first saw the Franco tattoo," Martín said, drawing Garza's attention back to the tablet,
I thought it might have been digitally added to the photo as a ploy, you know, to stir the pot. Conspiracy sites all compete for traffic, and the Francoist connection will get a massive response, especially considering the anti-Christian nature of Kirsch's presentation tonight.
Garza knew she was right. Conspiracy theorists will go crazy over this. Martin motioned to the tablet.
Read the commentary they intend to run.
With a feeling of dread, Garza glanced at the lengthy text that accompanied the photo. ConspiracyNet.com. Edmund Kirsch Update. Despite initial suspicions that Edmund Kirsch's murder was the work of religious zealots, the discovery of this ultra-conservative Francoist symbol suggests the assassination may have political motivations as well. Suspicions that conservative players in the highest reaches of Spanish government, perhaps even within the royal palace itself, are now battling for control in the power vacuum left by the king's absence and imminent death.
Disgraceful, Garza snapped, having read enough. All this speculation from a tattoo? It means nothing. With the exception of Ambra Vidal's presence at the shooting, this situation has absolutely nothing to do with the politics of the royal palace. No comment.
Sir, Martin pressed, if you would please read the rest of the commentary, you'll see that they are trying to link Bishop Valdespino directly to Admiral Avila. They are suggesting that the bishop may be a secret Francoist who has been whispering in the king's ear for years, keeping him from making sweeping changes to the country.
She paused.
This allegation is gaining a lot of traction online.
Once again, Garza found himself at a total loss for words. He no longer recognized the world in which he lived. Fake news now carries as much weight as real news. Garza eyed Martin and did his best to speak calmly.
Monica, this is all a fiction created by blog-writing fantasists for their own amusement. I can assure you that Valdespino is not a Francoist. He has served the king faithfully for decades, and there is no way he is involved with a Francoist assassin. The palace has no comment on any of it. Am I clear?
Garza turned toward the door, eager to get back to the prince and Valdespino.
Sir, wait!
Martin reached out and grabbed his arm. Garza halted, staring down in shock at his young employee's hand. Martin immediately pulled back.
I'm sorry, sir, but ConspiracyNet also sent us a recording of a telephone conversation that just took place in Budapest.
She blinked nervously behind her thick glasses.
You're not going to like this, either.
Chapter 38. My boss was assassinated. Captain Josh Siegel could feel his hands trembling on the stick as he taxied Edmund Kirsch's Gulfstream G550 toward the main runway at Bilbao Airport. I'm in no condition to fly, he thought, knowing his co-pilot was as rattled as he was. Siegel had piloted private jets for Edmund Kirsch for many years, and Edmund's horrifying murder tonight had come as a devastating shock. An hour ago, Siegel and his co-pilot had been sitting in the airport lounge, watching the live feed from the Guggenheim Museum.
Typical Edmund drama, Siegel had joked, impressed by his boss's ability to draw a huge crowd.
As he watched Kirsch's program, he found himself, along with the other viewers in the lounge, leaning forward, his curiosity spiking, until, in a flash, the evening went horribly wrong. In the aftermath, Siegel and his co-pilot sat in a daze, watching the television coverage and wondering what they should do next. Siegel's phone rang 10 minutes later. The caller was Edmund's personal assistant, Winston. Siegel had never met him, and although the Brit seemed a bit of an odd duck, Siegel had become quite accustomed to coordinating flights with him.
If you have not seen the television, Winston said, you should turn it on.
We saw it,
Siegel said. We're both devastated. We need you to return the plane to Barcelona, Winston said, his tone eerily businesslike considering what had just transpired. Prepare yourselves for takeoff, and I'll be back in touch shortly. Please do not take off until we speak. Siegel had no idea if Winston's instructions would have aligned with Edmund's wishes, but at the moment he was thankful for any kind of guidance. On orders from Winston, Siegel and his co-pilot had filed their flight manifest to Barcelona with zero passengers, a deadhead flight, as it was regrettably known in the business, and then had pushed back out of the hangar and begun their pre-flight checklist. 30 minutes passed before Winston called back. Are you prepped for takeoff?
We are.
Good. I assume you'll be using the usual eastbound runway?
That's right.
Siegel at times found Winston painfully thorough and unnervingly well-informed. Please contact the tower and request clearance to take off. Taxi out to the far end of the airfield, but do not pull onto the runway.
I should stop on the access road?
Yes, just for a minute. Please alert me when you get there. Siegel and his co-pilot looked at each other in surprise. Winston's request made no sense at all.
The tower might have something to say about that.
Nonetheless, Siegel had guided the jet along various ramps and roads toward the runway head at the western edge of the airport. He was now taxiing along the final 100 meters of the access road, where the pavement turned 90 degrees to the right and merged into the eastbound runway head.
Winston, Siegel said, gazing out at the high chain-link security fence that surrounded the perimeter of the airport property. We've reached the end of the access ramp.
Please hold there, Winston said. I'll be back in touch.
I can't hold here, Siegel thought, wondering what the hell Winston was doing.
Fortunately, the Gulfstream's rear-view camera showed no planes behind his, so at least Siegel was not blocking traffic. The only lights were those of the control tower, a faint glow at the other end of the runway, nearly 2 miles away.
60 seconds passed. This is air traffic control, a voice crackled in his headset. EC-346, you are cleared for takeoff on runway number 1. I repeat, you are cleared.
Siegel wanted nothing more than to take off, but he was still waiting for word from Edmund's assistant.
Thank you, Control, he said. We need to hold here just another minute. We've got a warning light that we're checking.
Roger that. Please advise when ready.
Chapter 39
Here?
The water taxi's captain looked confused.
You want to stop here? Airport is more far. I take you there.
Thanks. We'll get out here, Langdon said, following Winston's advice. The captain shrugged and brought the boat to a stop beside a small bridge marked Puerto Bidea. The riverbank here was covered with high grass and looked more or less accessible. Ambra was already clambering out of the boat and making her way up the incline.
How much do we owe you? Langdon asked the captain.
No pay, the man said. You're British man. He pay me before. Credit card. Triple money.
Winston paid already. Langdon was still not quite used to working with Kirsch's computerized assistant. It's like having Siri on steroids. Winston's abilities, Langdon realized, should come as no surprise considering daily accounts of artificial intelligence performing all kinds of complex tasks, including writing novels, one such book nearly winning a Japanese literary prize. Langdon thanked the captain and jumped out of the boat onto the bank. Before heading up the hill, he turned back to the bewildered driver, raised his index finger to his lips, and said,
Discreción, por favor.
Sí, sí,
the captain assured him, covering his eyes.
No he visto nada.
With that, Langdon hurried up the slope, crossed a train track,
and joined Ambra on the edge of a sleepy village road lined with quaint shops. According to the map, Winston's voice chimed on Edmund's speakerphone, you should be at the intersection of Puerto Bidea and the Rio Asua waterway. You should see a small roundabout in the town center.
I see it, Ambra replied.
Good. Just off the roundabout, you will find a small road called Baike Bidea. Follow it away from the village center. 2 minutes later, Langdon and Ambra had left the village and were hurrying along a deserted country road where stone farmhouses sat on acres of grassy pasture land. As they moved deeper into countryside, Langdon sensed that something was wrong. To their right, in the distance, above the crest of a small hill, the sky was aglow with a hazy dome of light pollution. If those are the terminal lights, Langdon said, we are very far away. The terminal is 3 kilometers from your position, Winston said. Ambra and Langdon exchanged startled looks. Winston had told them the walk would take only 8 minutes. According to Google's satellite images, Winston went on, there should be a large field to your right. Does it look traversable? Langdon glanced over at the hayfield to their right, which sloped gently upward in the direction of the terminal lights. We can certainly climb it, Langdon said, but 3 kilometers will take... Just climb the hill, Professor, and follow my directions precisely. Winston's tone was polite and as emotionless as ever, and yet Langdon realized he had just been admonished.
Nice job,
Ambra whispered, looking amused, as she started up the hill.
That's the closest thing to irritation I've ever heard from Winston.
EC-346, this is air traffic control, blared the voice in Siegel's headset. You must either clear the ramp and take off, or return to the hangar for repairs. What is your status?
Still working on it, Siegel lied, glancing at his rearview camera. No planes, only the faint lights of the distant tower. I just need another minute.
Roger that. Keep us apprised.
The co-pilot tapped Siegel on the shoulder and pointed out through the windshield. Siegel followed his partner's gaze but saw only the high fence in front of the plane. Suddenly, on the other side of the mesh of the barrier, he saw a ghostly vision. What in the world? In the darkened field beyond the fence, 2 spectral silhouettes were materializing out of the blackness, coming over the crest of a hill and moving directly toward the jet. As the figures drew closer, Siegel saw the distinctive diagonal black sash on a white dress that he had seen earlier on television. Is that Ambra Vidal? Ambra had flown on occasion with Kirsch, and Siegel always felt his heart flutter a bit when the striking Spanish beauty was aboard. He could not begin to fathom what in the world she was doing in a pasture outside Bilbao Airport. The tall man accompanying Ambra was also wearing formal black and white attire, and Siegel recalled that he too had been part of the evening's program. The American Professor Robert Langdon. Winston's voice returned suddenly.
Mr. Siegel, you should now see 2 individuals on the other side of the fence, and you will no doubt recognize both of them.
Siegel found the Brit's manner spookily composed.
Please know that there are circumstances tonight that I cannot fully explain, but I am going to ask you to comply with my wishes on behalf of Mr. Kirsch. All you need to know right now is the following.
Winston paused for the briefest of moments.
The same people who murdered Edmund Kirsch are now trying to kill Ambra Vidal and Robert Langdon. To keep them safe, we require your assistance.
But, of course, Siegel stammered, trying to process the information.
Ms. Vidal and Professor Langdon need to board your aircraft right now.
Out here? Siegel demanded.
I am aware of the technicality posed by a revised passenger manifest, but...
Are you aware of the technicality posed by a 10-foot-high security fence surrounding the airport?
I am indeed, Winston said very calmly. And, Mr. Siegel, While I realize that you and I have worked together only a few months, I need you to trust me. What I'm about to suggest to you is precisely what Edmund would want you to do in this situation." Siegel listened in disbelief as Winston outlined his plan.
"What you're suggesting is impossible," Siegel argued.
"On the contrary," Winston said, "it is quite feasible. The thrust of each engine is over 15,000 pounds, and your nose cone is designed to endure 700 mile...
"I'm not worried about the physics of it," Siegel snapped. "I'm worried about the legality and about having my pilot's license revoked."
"I can appreciate that, Mr. Siegel," Winston responded evenly. "But the future Queen Consort of Spain is in grave danger right now. Your actions here will help save her life. Believe me, when the truth comes out, you will not be receiving a reprimand. You will be receiving a royal medal from the King." Standing in deep grass, Langdon and Umbra gazed up at the high security fence illuminated in the jet's headlights. At Winston's urging, they stepped back from the fence just as the jet engines revved and the plane began rolling forward. Rather than following the curve of the access ramp, however, the jet continued straight toward them, crossing the painted safety lines and rolling out onto the asphalt skirt. It slowed to a crawl, inching closer and closer to the fence. Langdon could now see that the jet's nose cone was aligned perfectly with one of the fence's heavy steel support posts. As the massive nose cone connected with the vertical post, the jet engines revved ever so slightly. Langdon expected more of a fight, but apparently two Rolls-Royce engines and a 40-ton jet were more than this fence post could take. With a metallic groan, the post tipped toward them, pulling with it a huge mound of asphalt attached to its base like the root ball of a toppled tree. Langdon ran over and grabbed the fallen fence, pulling it down low enough that he and Umbra could make their way across it. By the time they staggered onto the tarmac, the jet's gangway stairs had been deployed and a uniformed pilot was waving them aboard. Umbra eyed Langdon with a tight smile.
"Still doubting Winston?"
Langdon no longer had any words. As they hurried up the staircase and into the plush interior cabin, Langdon heard the second pilot in the cockpit talking to the tower.
"Yes, Control, I read you," the pilot was saying, "but your ground radar must be miscalibrated. We did not leave the access ramp. I repeat, we are still squarely on the access ramp. Our warning light is now off, and we're ready for takeoff."
The co-pilot slammed the door as the pilot engaged the Gulfstream's reverse thrust, inching the plane backward away from the sagging fence. Then the jet began its wide turn back onto the runway. In the seat opposite Umbra, Robert Langdon closed his eyes for a moment and exhaled. The engines roared outside, and he felt the pressure of acceleration as the jet thundered down the runway. Seconds later, the plane was shooting skyward and banking hard to the southeast, plunging through the night toward Barcelona. Chapter 40. Rabbi Yehuda Kirvish rushed from his study, crossed the garden, and slipped out the front door of his home, descending the steps to the sidewalk. "I am no longer safe at home," the rabbi told himself, his heart pounding relentlessly. "I must get to the synagogue." The Dohani Street Synagogue was not only Kirvish's lifelong sanctuary, it was a veritable fortress. The shrine's barricades, barbed fences, and 24-hour guards served as a sharp reminder of Budapest's long history of anti-Semitism. Tonight, Kirvish felt grateful to hold the keys to such a citadel. The synagogue was 15 minutes away from his house, a peaceful stroll Kirvish took every day. And yet tonight, as he started out along Kossuth Lajos Street, he felt only fear. Lowering his head, Kirvish warily scanned the shadows before him as he began his journey. Almost immediately he saw something that put him on edge. A dark figure sat hunched on a bench across the street, a powerfully built man wearing blue jeans and a baseball cap.
poking casually at his smartphone, his bearded face illuminated by the glow of the device. He is not from this neighborhood, Kirvish knew, increasing his pace. The man in the baseball cap glanced up, watched the rabbi a moment, and then returned to his phone. Kirvish